in Canada who've shared this practice with me. It's something I'll take back to Buffalo for our events there, a city that's built on the traditional lands of the Seneca people, and we will honor that land that way, just as we would like to now for San Francisco that is on the traditional lands of Indigenous people. So thank you all. I'm going to introduce our three speakers in the order in which they're going to read, and then we'll go right to their papers. A.J. Carruthers is a poet and critic and the author of Access, an interdisciplinary lifelong poem, the first installment of which was published as Ariel in 2014. Jessica L. Wilkinson is a senior lecturer in creative writing at RMIT, University of Melbourne. She is the author of two works of biographical poetry, Marionette, a biography of Miss Marion Davies, and Sweet for Percy Grainger. Jessica is also founder and editor of Rabbit, a journal of nonfiction poetry. And also Fiona Heil, who is the author of Novelties, winner of the Kenneth Slessor Prize in 2014. Fiona has also authored stories, features, reviews, and interviews, and lives in Melbourne.
Thank you. I realize that I feel an immense sense of difficulty actually reading this paper now after what's happened, what's gone on with these incredible dialogues we've already been having. So, but I hope it does speak to something. But I think if I wrote it after the conference, which is of course impossible, it would have been very different to what it is. But let's see anyway. So it's called About That Long, which is that's actually the title of one of Astrid Lorange's poems, but I'm not going to talk about that. The subtitle is it's the same. Expansive Means in Contemporary Australian Inventive Poetry. And I've added a few there. I just added fun. Okay. Stressing Modes of Invention, to pinch the subtitle of Michael Farrell's recent book, Writing Australian Unsettlement, which we've been talking about a lot, is caught to an insurgent critical interest in experimental Australian poetry. Counteractive projects such as Farrell's only just begin to pitch to us a new case for forging a new critical history of Australian poetry attentive to invention. Because radically experimental poets do poetry in such a way that stipulates that we read otherwise than we are used to, a new critical language for these poetries is urgently required, I think. This is a critical experiment in which poetry and criticality are riskily and, I hope, actively entangled. Experiments begin with testing, proofing, concepting, a word I just made up, making errors, making procedures, composing other ways, stumbling off and on the page, off the Kate there. We get in at the level of the text, testing out lexical segmentivities, fractures, punctuations, dislocations, disorientations, and in Farrell's sense of it, unsettlements. But we also go over it at the level of the sociotext. Consider these readings middle distance readings, sometimes taking stock of the global measurements of bookhood, of cultural breadth and scale, other times getting right down to the grain of the text. Means of expansion. The guts of criticality. In an interview with Un magazine, Astrid Lorange notes that, quote, "Limits and infinities are a good way of framing a central paradox in my work. Poems are limiting technologies. They say, here's the poem, this is the line. They lay a certain claim, stake out a definite territory, but they are small, often fatally so. So their limits also suggest a limitlessness, or an infinity of alternatives. I guess poems are ways of showing how a limit can exist despite the always infinite context for action. That tension, what happens in writing as opposed to what could happen in writing but doesn't, is at the heart of how we read. It's the guts of criticality. Close quote. Poems are limiting technologies that is, with all the permutational, combinatorial, and generative possibilities that a limit point might occasion, we now know that procedural forms, with their banked-up border traffic of vernaculars and ever-widening geometries of attention, to cite Joan Retallack, are fruitful, even fractal means of expansion. But Lorange places the tension between limitation and infinite action in the guts. An appetitive criticality, to rehearse the Leibnizian term that she has also used, asks precisely what stomach we might have for critical reading, or even for reading at all. In these specific terms, a technics of expansion is found to stretch the fabric of the poem, or its stomach, pulling its materials into a larger temporal container than the shorter poem, which facets space and compacts time, no less infinitely, with its intricately spun lexical shards and segmentivities. This is not all about size, even if it is about voluminousness. Ebullience, accumulation, continuation, numbered sequence, and modular recurrence give off the ambient literary effects of expansion. From the get-go, even if the initial Moretian gravitational pull has estranged us from the text, at some point an expansive poem will plunge us back, rather than jettison us away from, the tiniest textual fibres that embody poetic work, or weaving, actually, for having yesterday. Next slide. Lorange's work crosses essay, exhibition, installation, index, poem, poem within poem, sequence, series, and means of expansion. I think of Lorange as contemporary, contemporal, contemporaneous, contempestuous, my contemporary, and a contemporary of our poetic community. Her contemporaneity, the title of one entry to her remarkable recent book, How Reading is Written, A Brief Index to Gertrude Stein, is marked by a devotion to the poetics of the index. Lorange is a Whiteheadian, Alfred North, drawing from strands of analytic philosophy, not just continental, which I always find interesting, and astonishingly productive of poetic thinking and practice for her. As Lorange suggests, language and reading can be thought of in terms of appetition. To blunt the allegory, reading is a kind of eating, a question taken up by or in Lorange's 2011 medium-length poem, Eating and Speaking, but also a writing investigative of expansive forms and critical formations of those forms. Here, I want to do a little distance reading of another work of poetic appetition, her 2013 book, Food Turns into Blood, which was Gauss PDF. Actually, it's in my bag, but I won't get it out. To generate the language for food, actually, I have to go through a couple of things. There's a couple more books there. Okay. To generate the language for food, turns into blood, but I'll just refer to it as food now, Lorange notes that she used an OCR scan, or optical character recognition, of Inui Jukichi's Japanese-English Dictionary of 1909, a textbook teaching English idiomatic phrases to speakers of Japanese. This quote, she says, rendered a lot of the language into noise, hundreds and hundreds of pages of it. I combed through and harvested lines and sentences in such a way that a kind of pseudo-detective novel was eventually composed. There's a central character, an exemplary he, but of course, because he is always merely the stand-in subject, his experiences are rarely subjectivised in any meaningful sense. The book, therefore, is a writing of a reading of citation and of translational error. Engendering a poetic lexicography whose gestures of multiple mediation begin with the optical character recognition system and end, perhaps ironically, with a partly subjective narratography. in the central male character. The OCR is an ocular default that will defy the machinic, even if it will require the machinic to get to a more subjectivized and gendered ambience. So let me zoom into a page here. Okay, so this is page 22. I guess I could read it. No, actually, I won't read it. It's in my bag, so yeah. Middle distance. The poem, distilled from lexicography, bucks the ready-made trend, talking it to something more like a ready-woven language, or, to invent a new term, plagiarism, a citational poetics that enrhythms, often lyrically so, a breathwork into or out of the source text. And I do this myself, which is a plagiarism. As if to whet our textual appetites, it begins smaller morsels. It begins with smaller morsels. A fruit, a nut, a berry. So, which in the original source text, which I went and looked at, is there. So you can see kenjutsu, a fruit, a nut, a berry. For the line, so that's that line. For the line, there is no cloud to disturb major. Major? Is it up there? No, it must be the next one. There it is. So, there is no cloud to disturb my jit. So, that comes out as MYJ there. The OCR, the Optical Character Recognition System, seems to have nicked the bracket and turned it into a J, omitting the word mind. The final three sentences of the passage read, a lamp hangs above the desk, a bridge hands over the river, my life hangs upon your decision. So you get another error there with the substitution of hands for hangs. The only omitted sentence is a piece of thread is hanging from your hat. So I assume that, Astrid, as you went through this, you decided to not put this sentence there. To tarry on this omission is to reconstruct a reading scene, not just a writing scene, but a reading scene. Means of expansion here hang upon a loose thread, the linguistic fibre that tenses the poem's expansivity, or its is the statement. Or it's the tension, as Lorange puts it, between, quote, what happens in writing as opposed to what could happen in writing but doesn't, kind of potentiality. Or again, the appetite that a citational poet might have for the source text knows its limits. That's it for Astrid. Now to Anya Woolwich. Sorry if that's a pathetic reading. In a 1996 interview, Woolwich defines her work as, quote, avant-garde writing, experimental writing, poetic, abstract writing. She goes on to say that, quote, how it fits into the Australian scene is very little work like that being done, so it doesn't fit in at all. It's sort of an anomaly, and yet attention has been paid to it, and it's being studied. So I am part of Australian literature. And I think perhaps in the future, this kind of work will be done more readily because someone has already established a position for it to be done. And I'm going to give a history of why that could or could not be true, but a little bit of stuff, especially for the Americans. It would be impossible to say now, I think, that very little work like this is being done. The clamour to be avant-garde in Australian poetry is, of course, a good thing. It's a statement. Woolwich, and to throw out a few other names, an completely incomplete list. Talia, Amanda Stewart, who's here, Pio, Chris Edwards, and Pam Brown, but many, many others as well. But those are the ones that are writing in an extreme style, I think, have established a position for a new wave of radically experimental writers to launch off of, as you US, whoever's left from USA here. Off of. I love that phrase, off of.
Where We're in the USA.
We are in the USA. Anya Wawrich, okay, so this is for the USA. Anya Wawrich was born in Poland in 1951, migrating to Australia in 1963, so not naturally born in Australia. Some of her books and writing, they're in my bag as well. I should have just gone to my bag before. Anyway, some of her books are Writing, 1982, Boat, 1989, Red Roses, 1992, and most recently, Palace of Culture, 2014. In that same interview I just mentioned, quoted above, Wawrich cites traditions of electronic music, John Cage, performance, language and sound composition as part of her poetic arsenal, adding that, quote, extreme theatrical delivery and the extreme format of writing bring her work along contemporary lines. So she uses the word contemporary to talk about her own work as well. So here's some of the books there. And I thought I'd just scroll a little bit so you can see this notion of the extreme format of writing, as she herself has called it. So there's that's from her earliest thing, Writing. From Red Roses, which is actually classed as a book of fiction. Anyway, I'll just scroll through that a little bit. So. That's not extreme enough? Okay. The extreme format of writing plays out in the structure of these books. Okay, so it's in the structure then, if it doesn't look extreme enough for Kate over there. Red Roses has no parts, so it's not modular, but a mostly continuous 214-page text, categorised as fiction, as said, but notably without chapters, so thus earning its poetic, this is a bit obvious, but thus earning its poeticity by denomination only, not generic category. Boat is divided into 100 parts, each of these making up a kind of chapter. It too is classed fiction. Then they're not poetry. Anyway, I don't even know what a poem is. Palace of Culture is composed of 50 parts, so three neat kinds, so that if you think of those three books, three sort of neat structures. No parts, 100 parts, 50 parts. So, and so this is a page from Boat here. So I'm just going to describe it a little bit. As if to at once lift us up above the chunky, blockish density of script and send us crashing back down into it, we first visualise its mix of Polish-English sociolect and glossolalic rhythms. In this vein, we might listen closely to the microtonemic contours of the or a voice. She's also an amazing performer. Or we might observe, not out of earshot or audition, but again from middle distance, the cracked disjunctive layers underneath the smoothly striated surface of its long open vowels and latristic cadences of d and l, watching them grate and bump up to each margin, left, right, north, south, diagonal, our eyes scanning the striations that gap each lexical unit. So I guess I'm saying here just to look at it, and not the words themselves, but rather the spaces around them. And it's an interesting thing looking at, in this middle distance sort of mode, how texts have those kind of white patterns that go down them, if that's what one wants to look at. But take another look. Viewed up close, notice some of the ulis in the previous section drifting or seeping across borderlines. Transegmental drift, as Garrett Stewart might say. Not enough border patrol to stop language crossing over. 100 pages later, a change of register brings us before painting, lifting us up, off, middle distancing ourselves once again from the page's allure to view something. Like Larange, if we look at this little circle here, I've just zoomed in a little bit, a tiny bit. Like Larange, paint here is both food and blood. The rhythmic appetition, eat, paint, mouthful, swallows, my saliva, dribbler, you, bite, into, cheeks, thicker, cream, squelch, raspberries, cuts, as if through the canvas, to a more ruddy textural complexion. Lush grasp edge cuts my fingers, bandage sinks in reds. She would read it differently and better. The global measurement of bookhood that I have tried to keep in perspective shows us that means of expansion, again, are nourished in kind by appetition. Eat that. Now to, I've decided to do three, exploring three writers here, so I apologise, Jess, for the brevity of this. This last bit is on stave work. Here it gets more confusing. Jessica Wilkins's notational experiments. If we can stomach some more experimental book work, I want to take a turn in closing to my friend, Jess here, author of most recently A Suite for Percy Grainger. She's written two books there, and The Suite for Percy Grainger is on the right. And you can see there the cover has scores on it, written sort of onto a tattoo, I guess, onto a body. I want to think of a score in poetic terms as a simultaneity of lines that both expand and disrupt the registers of our reading. Literary scores reconfigure the hemispheres of the page, getting us beyond the end of the poem. Here I am in late sway to the hemispheric turn and Gayatri Spivak's recent call to rethink nationalism and the imagination through what she calls critical regionalism. A hemispheric score for contemporary Australian poetry would take up geometries modelled not on East-West Orientalist situations or lines, but rather North-South diagonal, and I would say disorientalist, regionings. It might, for we cannot yet know, a hinge music, an axial centre around which means of expansion, capaciousness, continuation, future contingency might turn. Thank you.